Mr. McDermott, how much time did you want to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
All right. You may begin whenever you wish.
If it may please the court, I'm Peter McDermott from the Winchester Public Defender's Office for Mr. Dodson. This is a fairly straightforward issue in a lot of ways. At trial, defendant testified on his own behalf. Commonwealth attorney began to cross-examine him about not testifying at his preliminary hearing. Trial counsel did not object at that point, but did, at the time of jury instructions, ask for a curative instruction that is identified, I believe, as jury instruction number 10. That would be the standard instruction about the right of the accused not to testify and not have that commented upon. Again, trial counsel asked for that. There was some talk about whether or not that would be proper. Trial counsel explained why it would be proper to the court to give that instruction, given that Mr. Dodson did testify, but he wanted to let the court know about the preliminary hearing issue. That instruction was given to the jury. Trial counsel brought up that instruction during his closing argument. Then Commonwealth attorney, in rebuttal argument, returned to that well, said specifically, he doesn't have to testify, but that's correct, but there's no Kenny who is the person that...
Mr. McDermott, let me preface this question by telling you that in my long career in a courtroom, I've seen mistrials granted on much less. Having said that, I'm also acutely aware that the law is that you must raise an objection at the time the prosecutor makes an improper statement or asks an improper question in order to give the court an opportunity to fix it, and that even a motion for a mistrial that is made after the jury has retired is made too late. I find no objection at trial to any of the comments, improper comments of the prosecutor. So how do we get to where you want us to go?
Well, Judge, what I'm saying is that under Jimenez and under Harrison v. Commonwealth, both of which I cite, that the court actually has an affirmative duty to instruct the jury about the law. And that
it gave a proper instruction that was requested by the defense attorney.
Yes, Judge. And when that comes back around, when the Commonwealth makes that argument again, it is our position that the court had an affirmative duty to say at the end, that is not something you can consider.
But isn't that up to counsel, appellant's counsel, to raise the objection to the comments being improper?
Judge,
I think that's what Judge Petty's getting at in terms of the waiver.
I understand, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that Harrison v. Commonwealth, I think, supports our position. That in Harrison, Commonwealth made some improper arguments. The appellant requests for receiving an instruction. The Supreme Court found that the defense counsel said it was contrary to law instructions. Supreme Court found that
in a situation where the Commonwealth was making comments that were not only derogatory, but essentially equating him to be a traitor, which were not the charges that he was being on trial for. So isn't Harrison inapplicable?
Well, no, Your Honor. I think Harrison is actually directly on point. I think the points of Harrison are that the Commonwealth's making improper arguments. There's a requested for instruction. It's nonspecific, but then when the Commonwealth returns to that well, the court found that it was the duty of the judge to instruct the jury about what was proper. And if the court failed to, which I think is the position here, the court failed to, didn't just refuse, but failed to.
Let me stop you here, too, because let me ask, are we starting on an improper premise? You keep calling it a curative instruction.
Mm-hmm.
What we're looking at is the jury instruction that was offered. Wouldn't a curative instruction have come from the court if a timely objection had been made when the Commonwealth made the statement or asked the question? Isn't that the point where the court would then make the curative instruction?
I think it could have been. However, I believe that Jimenez and Harrison stand for the proposition that it is the court's affirmative duty to properly instruct the jury about the necessary, important constitutional rights of the defendant.
The defense attorney doesn't have any objection to it. I can imagine instances where, for tactical reasons, a defense attorney might ignore the comments, think that they're really not that substantial, and if I stand up and object, it's simply going to draw attention to that comment.
I think that the purpose of 5A18 to sort of is to put the court on notice, and I think the court had noticed that this was an issue when trial counsel asked for that instruction, and at that point the judge knew that this was an issue, that this was something he had to instruct the jury on, and it is our position that the judge, again, had the affirmative duty to do so. But if the court were to also find that it were not properly preserved, I think this is a place where 5A18 would be appropriate, the ends of justice rule, that under Brittle, we have showed the trial court erred, and that grave or manifest injustice, or that the defendant...
How do we know that the jury wouldn't have convicted but for the improper comments of the prosecutor?
I don't think that necessarily have to get to that point. I think the question is whether he was denied essential rights. Under Allen, defendant committed the larceny. And the court said, well, there's a due process issue when you that case revolves around whether or not he withdrew his appeal to the circuit court, and it was dismissed. But the court found that that was an appropriate place for the end of justice. I don't think we have to get to whether or not this crime occurred. I think it is whether or not he was denied an essential right. That right is not to have his silence at his preliminary hearing not be commented upon. And then we have to get to whether it's clear, substantial, and material. It's very clear. It's a constitutional right. It's substantial because the entire center of this case is about whether or not Mr. Dodson can be believed. And the fact that it keeps coming up again, it is of substance. It is of large size. And again, if it goes to the central issue, which is that's material. Materiality, I think, is shown here. It is vital to this case that the judge properly instruct. The jury was not properly instructed. The judge, I believe, the case law shows, had an affirmative duty to go out and say that what the Commonwealth attorney argued is against the law and the instructions that I gave you. You should not listen to that. And therefore, Judge, what we would ask is this case be remanded, set for retrial. And I will reserve any time.
Mr. Curry?
May it please the Court, Liam Curry on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia in this matter. In my brief, I set out what I thought were numerous procedural defaults that would prevent this court from reaching the merits of the appellant's claim.
Before we get to the procedural default, let's talk about the underlying objection. Do you agree that these comments were objectionable and improper?
It does appear that the cross-examination and the closing argument do make at the very least vague references to the defendant's election not to testify.
So the case turns on whether 5A18 precludes our addressing the issue.
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. Okay. And on the 5A18 issue, before we get to the 5A18 issue, it is the responsibility of the appellant to lay his finger on the error and to point this court in the direction of what is the substantive issue. And the appellant in this matter has elected to challenge the instruction of the jury. And the instruction, he's specifically challenging the manner in which the trial court instructed the jury on Mr. Dodson's right not to testify. There was no objection to that instruction, and the obvious reason why there was no objection is because the instruction on that issue was offered by the defendant. And the trial court accepted that instruction, and because not only was the instruction not objected to, the defendant has waived his ability to challenge it under the approbate and reprobate doctrines or the invited error doctrine because he cannot complain of the court's adoption of a legal theory concerning his client's rights that he himself introduced. And there's plenty of case law, or the Alford case at least stands for the principle that the invited error doctrine is broader than 5A18, Rule 5A18, and thus the ends of justice exception does not apply when an appellant has invited the error that he seeks reversal of on appeal. I think it just comes down to the fact, the next point I'd like to make, I guess, is that the instruction itself is accurate. It correctly states the law. It states that the defendant does not have to testify and that the jury is forbidden from considering the election of that right. Again, they're forbidden from considering that as evidence against him at trial.
Of course, the instruction was given prior to the Commonwealth's closing statement.
It was, Your Honor. It was, but the instruction was correct, and it still went to the jury room, and it was still considered by the jury when it considered the evidence in this case. And the case law is clear that there's a presumption that when a jury instruction is clear, that the jurors have followed clearly articulated instructions of law. I think another point is that this is a standard of review case as well. Because this is framed as a jury instruction case, it's only reversible upon an abuse of discretion. And I would put it to this court that a trial court does not abuse its discretion when it accepts a proffered instruction from a defendant about the defendant's right not to testify. That's not an abuse of discretion. It's a correct statement of law, and it's not subject to reversal on appeal. I think kind of a tangential argument that make up a large portion of opposing counsel's brief are on the prosecutorial misconduct claims, the improper cross-examination.
Were those ever presented, though, to the trial court?
No, Your Honor. The case law is clear that those types of allegations must be contemporaneously objected to. In this case, the issues were not affirmatively raised to the court until after a conviction had been entered. The case law is clear that the objections must be made contemporaneously or at the very least before the jury has retired. And I think the rationale that supports that law is clear. The Commonwealth is not suggesting that games were being played in this particular case, but it's possible that defense counsel, upon hearing the closing argument of the Commonwealth, might say, ooh, that might be the basis of a mistrial. However, I might be willing to roll the dice based on the sufficiency of the evidence that's presented that there might be an acquittal, and my client might be better served based on the presentation of the Commonwealth's evidence on that day, that it may be best not to object and then see if there's an acquittal. And if there is a conviction, you could always raise the issue for the first time on appeal or in a post-trial motion and ask this court to apply the ends of justice exception. And I think to prevent that possibility is why the contemporaneous objection rule is in place. Opposing counsel cites to Harrison. I think the primary difference in the Harrison case is there was a separate and specific assignment of error raising the issue of the improper closing argument. The other major distinction is that there was an objection in Harrison, a contemporaneous objection to the improper argument, and there was also I don't know if there was a request for a curative instruction, but a curative instruction was given. It was wholly improper or insufficient, so the matter was still reversed. But that's just a further demonstration of what counsel is required to do to preserve that type of issue on appeal. There was also a reference to the Maxwell case. The Maxwell case involved a defense attorney who had no ability to contemporaneously object because the trial judge answered questions of the jury outside of the presence of counsel and outside of the presence of the defendant through no fault of the defendant or defendant's counsel. Here there's The record is clear that the defendant and counsel were present at the time the remarks were made, and there was ample opportunity to object contemporaneously. I guess in summary, the defendant didn't timely object to improper cross-examination. He didn't object timely to any improper closing argument, and he failed to assign error on either basis on appeal. And the jury instruction that he presented to the court was accurate, and the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it accepted it and submitted it to the jury. And for those reasons, unless there are further questions from the panel, I ask this court to affirm on that basis.
Thank you, Ms. Curry. Mr. McDermott.
Mr. McDermott, I want to ask you on your ends of justice argument.
Yes, sir.
Our case law on ends of justice is pretty strict. It says that a miscarriage of justice must have occurred, not might have occurred. And we have language that talks about an individual being convicted for a crime he didn't commit. The evidence in this case, the defense in this case was, I wasn't driving. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that is fair.
The evidence is pretty compelling. The deputy sheriff literally pulled the guy out of the driver's seat of the car after he wrecked, put him down on the ground, put handcuffs on him, and put him in the back of his cruiser, and he was in the back of the cruiser when the state trooper arrived and also identified him. How can we possibly say that a manifest injustice has occurred here, given the language or the argument of the Collins attorney?
Well, I think where we would get to is the question, and that's sort of, I think, part of the question in Campbell as well. But that's also a jury instruction question. And there was a lot of quantum of evidence in Campbell that the crime actually had been committed, even though the portion of the jury instruction was left out in that case. The court found that a missing portion of the instruction or an improperly instructed jury can lead to an ends of justice question without worrying about the quantum of evidence for what was actually for the missing portion of the instruction. For that element was missing from the instruction. There was quantum of evidence showing that they could meet that element, and the court said that's not the question. They have to be properly instructed. And I think that gets us to the ends of justice here. They were just not properly instructed, and for that reason, this case should be remanded. I would like to briefly respond. I think the Commonwealth's argument that we're not laying our finger on the error or that we invited this error, I think is misplaced here. We did ask for this instruction, but that's not where we're saying really the error ends. The error is in not instructing the jury at the end. Once that argument is made, the court is on notice that this is an important issue that the jury need to be instructed on, and the Commonwealth tries to undo the instruction with his argument. And I think the court has a affirmative duty, as it says in Jimenez, to instruct the jury. And at that point, I believe it is the court's duty to instruct the jury about that constitutional standard. If there are no further questions, I would ask this court to remand this for trial.
Thank you, counsel.